Monday, August 29th, I was determined to get some work done. 2 days of self-indulgence leaves me vaguely restive and conscience-ridden. I was going into Austin to settle some purchases at Oriole's house and to oversee what was happening at Lucy's apartment. But getting off was delayed by innumerable calls. Mr. Pike, Lucia, James, trying to set up my business of the day. There was a blurb in the paper about the Manchester book, which will be serialized by Look within the next few months before it comes out as a book, which promises 1,000 revelations of exciting portent. One line predicting that President Johnson will have to read it and he won't like it. It was like the inviting outside cover of a movie magazine, which promises all sorts of lurid revelations, though the story frequently turns out to be innocuous enough. It is finally being borne in upon me, though, reluctant as I am, that there does seem to be a concerted, planned wave of attacks, small, niggling, big, harmful, aimed at us. My ambition is to ignore them and go full steam ahead with the business at hand most of the time and taking gratefully such days of peace as we've had off these last two. Finally, at 11, I left with Linda for Austin, going first to Lucy's apartment. When I opened the door, crepe paper streamers were strung in loops across the ceiling. Enormous bright crepe paper flowers, the Mexican variety, were scotch taped to the walls. It was a profusion of red, blue, yellow, green, and there was a huge note by the door, "Welcome home," and some gay foolishness signed by several of her friends, including Betty Beale, whom I recognized as the artist. It was Linda's first time to see it. I must say it did look quite well. In Washington, sometime early last week, I had discussed with Lucy quite calmly what she might want to use of my furniture. I would give her the big sofa, Linda two of my chairs from the solarium, Linda the desk secretary, used to be in the corner of the living room at 30th Place, Linda my green dining room chairs, we might talk about other things, and give her another TV set. But I thought she'd better measure everything and be quite careful to see if it would fit in and look well, and then when she decided, we'd see if we could get it shipped down. Last Friday, there had been an hilarious conversation with Helen, when I had asked her to measure some of the things for Lucy so that she could see when she reached her apartment whether they might fit. And Helen began to giggle, and then I discovered that everything I had mentioned, barely, and one thing in addition that I hadn't mentioned, Lucy had already decided on, and they were already en route to Austin. As I looked at the apartment, I thought they were actually rather a success. Big though it was, the old sofa, which is about the same age as Lucy, looks very well, and the two chairs are perfect. And the secretary desk adds some distinction to the room, as well as an opportunity to show off some of Lucy's beautiful things. The chest from the long-ago master bedroom in 30th Place will serve very well, perhaps even after Lucy chooses bedroom furniture of her own. Helen was up to her ears in boxes and tissue paper, assorting, putting away, thinking it out for Lucy. What a lot of love has gone into this on the part of James and Helen. I overheard Helen talking to someone on the phone. "I'm not going to leave this house until everything's in order. That child come in here and see all these boxes stacked up. I think she'd sit down in the middle of the floor and cry." How nice it is to be loved as Lucy is loved. I was ravenously hungry, and we went to Youngblood's restaurant, Linda and I, where Carolyn joined us and took us to lunch. Fried chicken, hot rolls, and honey in abundance. I've never seen Carolyn so pretty, big though she is. Her baby is to be born in October. I went alone to Shanks, and Mr. Pike, my old partner, in jobs big and little, had assembled some very nice fabrics to do over Oriole's old Victorian sofa. We chose a soft green that would look well with the cedar walls and afford a fairly nice compromise between the Victorian lines of the sofa, the boxy straight lines of her golden oak furniture. We settled on the refinishing of bureau, tables, chairs, as James drove up with a truckload full of them. It would be so easy simply to discard them all and buy her some completely new ones. But at 75 or so, I cannot help but believe she would be lonesome for the thing she's lived with all of her life. And it would be mistaken generosity, even arrogance, to insist that she store them and then make her a gift of new things. It was 2:30 before I left, returned to Lucy's to change into blue jeans and boots and meet Roy White and go to Johnson City. Our business was to take the plan for the old Fort site that had been prepared by Robert White of A&M College, and the senior class in landscape architecture, to walk out their plans, step by step to follow the proposed road as best we could. We found Mr. Hartman there, riding the shredder, beginning at the northwest side, and cutting down the weeds. To my great pleasure, he had left several clumps of lantana, which, because of the rain, were masses of yellow and orange and sometimes pink flowerets. He'd done a fair job of leaving some bunches of prickly pear, and I pointed out a great picturesque century plant, a real ornament to the landscape, and asked him to guard it carefully as he shredded. Roy and I began at the highway, and with his 300-foot tape located the entrance, and then stepped off the road, going by his scale and the trees and such landmarks as the old fort. We decided they'd done a rather good job of a flowing, gently curving road that approached the fort, had some parking places, and then meandered on down through the pecan grove to cross the creek at the same street on which Lyndon's boyhood home sits, a block farther up into town. Now the problem is to hire Melvin Winters to put the road in and to get Roy White to drive on a jeep along the road a time or two to test it out along with Melvin's man. It appears we'll only lose 3 pecan trees. The weeds were knee-high and sometimes above and very thick going, sort of like taking exercises with pressure applied against you. And take 2 steps and you're covered with beggar lice. Twice a covey of quail flushed up right under our feet with an exciting whir of wings, one of them about 8 or 10. How I wish that would still happen when we clear out the weeds. I know it won't. It's either quail or people, and I hope that people will use this. We plan to put in about $100 worth of bluebonnet seeds in the northwest corner, which is quite open country. Robert White's plan is fairly ambitious, though most of his trees and shrubs are purely native. Sumac, Texas persimmon, azurita, retama. When we were hot and tired and thirsty and reasonably content that no violence would be done to the landscape, that in fact it would be opened up rather charmingly by the road, we climbed in the car, drank the last of the cold drink picked up at the filling station, and left for the ranch. Lyndon had suggested this morning that we move the barn since they need new pens. Just pick up and move the whole thing up on the hill close to Dale's. And I had put in my word to build a better workshop for Mr. Klein if we were going to do improvements, or at the very least to put a good roof on the one he had. So we called Dale and Mr. Klein to stand by to advise us on needs, size, location, uses it would be put to for a workshop, and also to discuss the real need for moving the barn and pens, which I actually don't want to. It is a farm and ranch. I like for it to look like one, with the supporting buildings where the work goes on. And actually now, the pens on the hilltop used mostly. We are not bothered by the flies and rats and smell, which used to be the great drawback to the pens close to the house. And the barn itself is just a good sturdy structure bursting with hay and grain that says, this is a working ranch. Well, on the way we got sidetracked, which was not unexpected since the magic hour was approaching, twilight, and Lennon was taking to his car after a day of being office-bound and phone-bound, anxious to spend his last 2 or 3 hours in the fading light doing what he liked best. He had the Crims and the Valentes with him and Jesse Kellum. He heard us on the talking machine asking Dale and Mr. Klein to stand by. He asked us instead to join him. It's very hard to say no, particularly on the last day we'll be here for an unknown time, and particularly since I had been working rather hard at other things all day. So we met him at the Scharnhorst. Roy and I got in the open-top car with him, Matilda and Jesse and Mary, and we traveled the new road in the Scharnhorst that climbs the hills in the southern part of the granite pasture and winds through the underbrush and rocks and then out onto the open meadow, all of it the part of the ranch that the black buck antelope like. Twice we saw them, bounding along in great leaps like ballet dancers, much more visible than our native deer, with their bright white markings, mostly their underbodies, their horns absolutely straight, always running in single file, rather like they had rubber balls on the bottom of their feet that jump so high. And yet, when they approach a fence, they come to a dead standstill. They will not jump a fence. And this herd of antelope stays always in the same pasture. They're called black buck antelope, and I hear that the buck turns black somewhere around 5 years of age. None of them have yet. As we rode through the granite rock pasture, suddenly we saw the ghost of a full moon, faintly silver behind a wreath of clouds, right on the eastern horizon toward the river pasture, and exactly balanced on the rim of the horizon on the west, the bright red globe of the sun sinking behind the granite rocks of the Scharnhorst. This we saw as we came to the top of a hill, and they hung balanced there perfectly for a few moments while we sat and stared. It was a sight to remember. We rode on through the Tomlinson. A.W. joined us, and we went through the river pasture and traveled a road that hugs the brink of the river itself, high above, a most precipitous, rugged road with a marvelous view, upriver and downriver for miles. Benton has just had it completed. He keeps on saying, "If I don't get roads built this year, I never will. If I don't get these fences built this year, I never will." But that has been his motto all his life, it seems to me. Running to attain some goal that is always elusive, always just out of reach, and pursued by what? Old age? Failure? Inability to attain what he's trying to? At any rate, it seems he's been in a race his entire life. When the last ray of light was gone and the moon ruled the night, we started home. Mary met us with a big tray of Noche specials. How could I be hungry? I was ravenous. We sat down to black-eyed peas from the garden and delicious ripe tomatoes, our own, and squash and roast beef and cornbread. And then it was time to board the little plane and head for San Antonio and Air Force One and Washington, which we finally reached about 2:30. With no sleep, it does not come just because I have time for it. Lindbergh played bridge. I was sorry I wasn't wide enough to play with her. And by 3 o'clock, we were in the White House, in bed.